Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the AgriLinks webinar series. I am Adam Ahmed with AgriLinks, and today I welcome you to a webinar that we are having on what's lurking in your value chain, uncovering the hidden costs of gender-based violence in agriculture. So if you see the chat pod on your screen, you can engage with us through there. Type in any questions that you may have, and we'll try to answer them in the chat pod, and we will be saving the longer questions for the Q&A portion of this webinar at the end. Without further ado, I would like to introduce our first presenter, who will be framing today's topic. Her name is Krista Jacobs, and she is the Senior Gender Advisor at the Bureau for Food Security.
Hi, good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, everyone. I hope you all can hear me. Thank you for the introduction, Adam. I'm going to introduce our presenters today and then move into a bit of framing, and then we will hear our two great examples. Our first presenter joining us from Tanzania is Rodrigo Abbott from ACDI VOCA. Rodrigo is a technical research specialist with the Tanzania Nafaka 2 project, where he leads the development and implementation of the project's learning agenda. Before joining Nafaka, Rodrigo held different appointments in both the public and private sector, as well as an international organization. His work focuses on bridging the gaps between research and implementing evidence-based actions at the field level to achieve sustainable rural development. Rodrigo holds a bachelor's in agriculture from the National University of Asuncion and a master's in agribusiness from Texas A&M through a Fulbright. Welcome, Rodrigo. We also have two colleagues joining us today from Unilever. The first is Deline Fisher, who is the Vice President of Supply Chain for East Africa and Unilever Tea Plantations based in Nairobi. She manages the fast-moving consumer goods supply chain in high-growth emerging markets across Kenya, Ethiopia, Uganda, Rwanda, and Tanzania, as well as the tea plantations in Kenya and Tanzania, with approximately 15,000 employees. Deline has over 25 years of supply chain experience and has worked with various commerce and a master's degree administration from the University of Stellenbosch. We also have with us today Winfrieda Nyakwara from Unilever. She's an experienced human rights lawyer, gender specialist, and social sustainability professional from Kenya. She has over 12 years of experience in human rights, gender, and sustainability work. Winfrieda has a law degree from Moi University in Kenya and a master's in international development from the University of Edinburgh. Winfrieda is the Integrated Social Sustainability Manager for Africa at Unilever, where she provides leadership at a local level to embed human rights in the tea operations in Kenya, and she was also part of the team that launched the Safety for Women, Boys, and Girls program in tea operations in East Africa. Welcome, Winfrieda. We also have with us this morning Jennifer Williamson from ACDI VOCA, is their Senior Director for Gender and Social Inclusion. So I'm very excited about this webinar today because talking about gender-based violence in our agricultural programs and in our the communities where we work is not a conversation we've been having as openly as we could. Gender-based violence is an inherently sensitive and complex topic. It's also not something that many agriculture experts are familiar with or comfortable addressing, even though they may be aware of gender-based violence happening associated in their communities and in their work, and often don't want to address it for fear of making it worse. Also, we recognize that gender-based violence happening in the communities where we work and associated with their programs may not be something that you want to bring up to your donor. So with this webinar, we're really hoping to start a conversation where we in the agriculture sector can begin to face some of these fears about preventing and responding to gender-based violence and talking about gender-based violence in the sector and in our programming. But to get us on the same page, I wanted to give one definition of gender-based violence, and this is from the U.S. government's strategy to prevent and respond to GBV globally, which defines gender-based violence as violence directed at an individual based on his or her biological sex, gender identity, or perceived adherence to socially defined norms of masculinity and femininity. It includes physical, sexual, and psychological abuse, threats, coercion, arbitrary deprivation of liberty, and economic deprivation, whether occurring in public or private life. And so we need to acknowledge that gender-based violence is happening in the communities we work in. The WHO estimates that 35% of women have experienced either physical or sexual violence, and those are just two aspects of the definition of violence that we just covered. We also need to be always mindful that gender-based violence has profound impacts on survivors. For example, women who've experienced physical or sexual intimate partner violence report higher rates of depression, sexually transmitted infections, including HIV, injuries, anxiety disorders, suicide or self-harm, unwanted pregnancy, and babies with low birth weight. Survivors may also suffer isolation, inability to work, loss of wages, lower participation in regular activities, and a more limited ability to care for themselves or their children. The survivors are facing loss of income and productivity, not participating fully in economic life, which may include some of the programs that we are working and hoping to engage people in, and also not fully participating in social life, and we know that those connections, that social life in addition to support, also fosters social connections and connections with information and services, which are often vital to the work that we're trying to do. You'll see this picture, which I've excerpted from CARE's publication, Counting the Cost of Violence, and I wanted to highlight it here because I think it does a good job of articulating the costs of gender-based violence for survivors, families, perpetrators, businesses, and communities. And I raise this not to bring GBV down to a monetary calculation, but to show that while gender-based violence is intensely personal, its effects are far-reaching and costly to society as a whole. So I'm sorry that the graphic is a little bit blurry, but in addition to the consequences that we just talked about, there are also costs when survivors are accessing health services, legal services, when they are relocating or seeking a safe space to be, as well as the loss of income. Businesses face absenteeism, high turnover, and lost productivity, and there are also social costs that everyone bears through the cost that the government is paying. For example, in Peru, speaking of businesses, companies lose more than $6.7 billion per year as a result of absenteeism, staff turnover, and lost productivity resulting from domestic violence. The World Bank has estimated in some countries that gender-based violence can cost up to 3.7% of GDP. And in some of the countries where we work, agriculture is responsible for 40% of GDP. So just doing a very quick and dirty back-of-the-envelope application of those two percentages, in some of the places where we work, gender-based violence in the agriculture sector and in rural communities may be costing up to 1 to 2% of GDP. Gender-based violence, or the fear or the expectation of violence, can lower women's participation in our programs, which is a reality that I think a lot of us face and think about. It can affect how women do or don't decide to participate. But it can also affect programs' effectiveness and their choices. I've been in conversations everywhere from homes and villages to boardrooms around which crops, livestock, or activities projects can work in and choose so that women will be able to participate, earn money, and have leadership, but not so much earning or so much visibility that it would attract attention and lead some people to decide to perpetrate violence against the women or to appropriate their resources and earnings. So much of the work that we do, because it changes resources and their allocation, incomes, decision-making, who has access to information and services and visibility, is going to change power dynamics, and I don't think that we can get around that, nor should we pretend that that doesn't happen. Those shifting dynamics, or the anticipation of them, can increase the risk of violence, and we should be anticipating and watching for that risk. But those same shifts can also be opportunities to create space for people to reflect on the norms and behaviors and make choices away from violence. So today, we'll see examples from an agriculture project and an agribusiness about how each of them chose to engage and grapple with gender-based violence. And with that, I will turn it over to Rodrigo.
Thanks, Krista. And it's a pleasure to be here today representing HCDA Boca and the NAPACA project to share with everyone on the other side the project's journey to empower a community in the fight against GBV. So let's get started. You will hear the word NAPACA a lot today. So let me start by explaining the meaning. In Swahili, the local language here in Tanzania, it means cereal. And as our name says, we are a market system project, and our work is to strengthen both the rice and the maize value chains, focusing on increasing access to credit and agricultural inputs, as well as to improve our farmers' abilities to aggregate commodities that will later be sold to either millers, processors, and other end market buyers. So to accomplish this goal, we conduct a set of activities that are grouped under three components. The first one is strengthening the input supply value chain. And to do so, we support demonstration sites for improved inputs and good agricultural practices. As a part of the activities under this component, we have also developed a system of last mile retailers to make sure that farmers at the village level can have timely access to improved agricultural inputs. In our second component, so we work with 300 or about 345 producer organizations to increase their ability to market the members' commodities. And we also provide trainings that will lead to an increased institutional and human capacity. And under our component three activities, we connect millers and processors with farmers and producer organizations to purchase commodities. We also have a very strong focus on food fortification, especially with maize flour, to reduce malnutrition rates in the zones of influence. So as a value chains project, all of these components are interconnected, and the success of one of them is reliant upon the success of the other components. As you can see, we have a very broad scope of work with a very diverse set of activities, but also complementary. So in order to track our progress, we have historically monitored our performance by using indicators like PMTs. We then validate these indicators with experiences from the field through interactions with several market actors and, of course, our beneficiaries. We acknowledge that even impactful interventions can be unsustainable due to the lack of studies on the reasons behind the effectiveness of certain interventions. So in year two, or out of a four-year program, we began the transition towards an evidence-based project with the specific goal of testing the causal relationship between some of our key interventions and their impact. We needed to bring clarity to the path that we were walking on, and to do so, we adopted USAID's CLA approach, so collaborating, learning, and adapting, as a tool to assist us in the process of generating sustainable impact. And this transition wasn't always easy. In this path, we encountered many, many organizational challenges. For those who want to read more about it, I'm not going to go in depth, but I've shared a case study where we explain this transition. You'll see it on the left of your screen under file downloads. So I think senior staff did a really good job in not imposing the creation of this culture. Instead, it was slowly developed or nurtured by including activities like pause and reflect sessions in our regional meetings and also monthly meetings, where we encourage a safe space atmosphere where all questions were good questions. And each of the staff that participated were encouraged to share both failures and successes. And after some time, we started to reap the benefits of this new learning culture. We saw an increase in awareness of what can be achieved through research, and a lot of the learning questions nowadays are coming from our junior staff. So there's also a higher level of engagement with the project, and I personally believe this is a consequence of a deeper comprehension of the why behind the impact. We've also seen an increased ability on the side of our staff to do more external collaborations. And in fact, NAFACA is receiving a lot of requests for the staff to participate in conferences, implementer collaboration activities, and even government councils. So as a part of this transition towards a project that generates evidence to take action, we set out to measure one of the most emblematic interventions of the project, which is the provision of mechanization grants. For the past 2 years, NAFACA has worked to deliver technology to several selected producer organizations. And by technology, I mean equipment for land preparation, for example, power tillers, and also equipment for harvest and post-harvest activities that can be maize shellers, rice threshers, or rice cutters. So the project effort aligned also with the plans of the government of Tanzania to address the low levels of mechanization in the country. And this is a big problem among rural women who constitute the largest labor force in the agricultural sector of the country with a rate of about 52%, which I think is one of the highest in Africa. So our initial plan was to cover all the producers organizations that received this mechanization grant, so about 40 producer organizations, that and our POs have an average size of 150 members. So as you can see, this was intended to be a large-scale survey that was going to require the use of enumerators to collect data. And our initial interest was to measure the effect of these grants on two specific variables. The first one was the amount of time saved by using the machine versus performing this task manually, and also the income generated at the PO level as a result of providing these services in the village. So where I come from, we have a phrase that doesn't have a direct translation in English, but it would be something like, the paper can withstand every idea, but implementing those ideas is a different thing. And this was around my first month in the project. And after defining the methodology, I realized that in that year, 2018, the program had conducted two or three large studies. So the reality was that we didn't have enough resources to use enumerators in this process. And we said to ourselves, okay, we're going to scale down the intervention and adapt the methodology to the available resources. So we agreed to focus on, instead of 40, just one producer organization. We were also going to involve the project staff to assist in the data collection. And we were going to use diaries, time diaries, instead of digital collection tools. And we're going to provide these diaries to farmers, which are going to input data. So the new research design resulted in a higher burden of work for the team. But it also allowed for more flexibility and the opportunity to expand our objectives. So from our initial objective, which was to measure the grant effect on as a time-saving technology and also as a means to generate income, we included two additional objectives. The second one was to determine the gender gap in time allocation. We were interested in finding out the intra-household dynamics. How are men and women using their time at the village level or in the house? And a third objective was to understand time use patterns throughout an agricultural season. So we started this activity in December of 2018, and we said to ourselves, why don't we collect data on key moments of the season to better understand how farmers are investing their time through the agricultural season, so that will provide information to us that will enable us later on take actions on how to help them to save time. And today's presentation will focus a lot on the second component, the intra-household dynamics. So since we plan to understand the intra-household dynamics, we decided to work with couples from the producer organization. And as the title says, we turned them into enumerators. They were full-timers, and for the week that we worked with them, they became part-time enumerators. Farmers were collecting their own data. Since they were collecting data, then we needed to train on how to do this, how they were going to categorize their daily activities and to group it into the diary. For instance, there was a category in the diary that was named household chores. So we taught farmers that activities like sweeping the floor, cooking, fetching water were categorized as going out with friends or watching a football match belong to social activities. And this process wasn't easy. For a lot of women, for instance, childcare was not seen as work. Well, we had cases where a lot of our female farmers thought that fetching water was leisure. They didn't perceive this as work before. So it took some time for farmers to grasp these concepts. We also worked with separate groups. So we had female staff working with female farmers and male staff working with male farmers. And we thought that this would increase the confidence in case there were sensitive topics that came up in the discussions. And that way we would also avoid any influence from men over women or perhaps not wanting to share something that you don't want your couple to know. So farmers would record their time use data for a 7 days period. And during that week, we went back to the village several times to do data quality assessments to all the households that were participating in the activity. We needed to make sure that they were properly categorizing the activities, that they were not forgetting about any activities, that they were also including all the hours that they worked throughout the day. In a week after we delivered the journals, we went back and collected the diaries and we engaged in discussions with farmers about their experiences, the challenges, and also, of course, the learnings in this process. So as you can see from these pictures, this was a very participative process. There was a very close relationship between teacher and students, let's say, in this case, with an AFACA figure being the teacher, and also among students. So a month after collecting the data, we went back to the village for two reasons. This picture is from a debriefing session in January of 2019. And as I said, we went back to the village for two reasons. First, for accountability purposes. This activity created a lot of expectations on the side of farmers who wanted to see the results of their work. They were very curious about how they were using their time. And the second reason was to validate the results. We needed to see if the information that we got from the journals really reflected the reality at the field level. And during these conversations, we realized that the diaries, coupled with an increased trust from working in groups, had a consequence that we did not initially foresee. They were disclosing a lot of information, especially women, that they couldn't share in their communities. About the inequalities that they were subject to at the household level. And here is where we started hearing stories about intimate partner violence. So some of the women told us their husbands came drunk at night and beat them for no apparent reason. Others said that they would be open about the income earned with their couples, but when they asked their husbands the same question, they would be beaten or cursed. And violence was not only physical. We had examples of women who would work for a whole agricultural season in their plots. They would harvest the rice, and at some point before they sold it, the husband came to the plot and already finished the transaction with an intermediary, and they would have no idea, the women that owned those plots would have no idea about the income generated or the amount of cereals that were sold. In this case, we were working with rice farmers. So these women seem to be trapped in this circle of violence, and what is worse, they felt powerless because they did not see a way out of it. And I would lie if I said we were not uncomfortable with this situation and that we immediately knew what to do. I remember being in the car on our way back after that discussion, and the whole team was somehow in a state of shock. Confronting these issues can be paralyzing, especially because our expertise is deeply rooted in agriculture and not in gender-related issues. So our first reaction was to seek help externally. We said that there were certainly people out there that had the proper training to address GBV directly. So we contacted several projects here in the country that were working with gender-based violence, and we shared their contact information with the farmers that were subject to this situation, to this problem. We took another step and we say, okay, we reach out to the local government authorities to push for the creation of a gender desk at the local police station. So this would be a specific room that has the proper infrastructure to provide privacy when a woman is going to the police station to report a GBV case. And it also, of course, has to have a trained personnel to address these issues. But we felt a sense of dissatisfaction, to be honest. This was not enough. the impact of these actions, the external collaboration actions, were somehow out of the project's control. And women in that community trusted us with the information because they believed we could help them. So they did not discuss these issues in their villages because sharing these concerns were embarrassing and frowned upon. And more importantly, because women were not believed over men. So this is where we started reflecting about what we could do as a project. And that the learning culture that I described before was fundamental in this process. We started this process in which we went back to reflect on the evidence that collected. And here we discovered a few things. So we did a survey of our 345 producer organizations, and we were trying to understand the leadership structure. So we realized that leadership positions are dominated by men. Between 70 to 75% of men occupy key positions like chairperson, secretary, and coordinator. The only position where the balance tilts towards women is treasurer. And this is not because men trust women on how to allocate the money, but they do trust them on keeping their money. So something that I should mention is that because of logistical reasons, when we provide trainings to producer organizations, we conduct them with the leaders. And after this, they are the ones that should cascade this knowledge with their members. But we started digging deeper, and we realized that the communication flow was inadequate, and that these trainings were not always shared, or the knowledge of these trainings was not always shared with members. So we had to be very careful, because indirectly, we could have been concentrating opportunities on leaders, and in this case, they were men, which could have exacerbated the differences and the knowledge gap between men and women. So the second piece of evidence was to analyze the effectiveness of our trainings. We said we sit down with the women at the village that participated in the time diary activity, and we realized that those who participated in APACA trainings inside their POs had more decision power in their households, and they did have an influence over how money was allocated. Coincidentally, 75% of the women that had access to these trainings were leaders. So we realized that trainings and access to leadership can empower women by giving them more confidence and skill to actively participate in the household decisions. And the last piece of the puzzle, and the one that allowed us to see the whole picture, were the diaries, the information that the diaries provided. We realized that there was an uneven distribution of time. Women worked for about 2 or 3 additional hours per day compared to their male counterparts. And the largest portion of this working time was dedicated to domestic and care work. So about 60% of women's working time was dedicated to more reproductive activities, while men only spent 23% of their time on the same task. So these three pieces of information came as a revelation to us. They made us realize that GBV was the consequence of a much bigger problem, which is the social and cultural perception of women in rural societies. Women are perceived as less capable of doing certain activities, and they are confined to reproductive and non-remunerated work. So the decision-making ability is also restricted, especially when we talked about income. And these perceptions are the ones that affect their participation in capacity-building opportunities and in taking more leadership positions. So once we embrace this reality, we were compelled to act to eliminate GBV by attacking the roots of the problem. We realized that we could do so through what we did best, which is agricultural interventions. And so NAFACA implemented a three-stage approach. The first thing that we did was to say we acknowledge that our trainings do have an effect on women's capacity and the image in gaining confidence to be active members in their community. So we said we need to increase the number of women who participate in our trainings. And we did this by enforcing an effective cascading system. So after we conducted every training with the leadership, what we did was to schedule in the next two weeks, a session in which the leadership would cascade this training to the rest of their members. So we agreed on a date, and then Denafaka staff went back to the village during that date to check that the training was really taking place, and also to register the amount of people that were participating. We took a step further, and we also talked to the leadership of APO to ask them a database of their members and their phone numbers. And we have an SMS platform by which we can send messages to different people, in this case, the members of the community, at a very low cost. So what we did was to, before the training, we sent a message to all the members, letting them know that there was a training happening on a specific topic, on a specific date, and the location where it was going to take place. The second step was to attempt to change the leadership structure of these producer organizations. So for this, we identified all the POs that were conducting election before the end of this year, and also throughout 2020. 2 or 3 weeks before members present the formal application to become candidates, we conduct trainings with the community and with that producer organization, in which we highlight the importance of including women and youth in the leadership structure. We have also continued with our women's empowerment training, but we do them a bit differently. We have seen that this approach, where we invite the couple to participate, work certainly more effective. It's certainly more effective than individual trainings. And this is because it increases the accountability at the household level. So both members of the couples have been exposed to the training. They know that there are certain things that must be changed, and this encourages discussions at the household level. During the following rounds of data collection, we also brought in our regional gender specialists to listen to women and to work with them with a more gender-specific approach. I would also like to highlight in this process the role of USA, which I think its support has been instrumental in this process to address the when we approach them with the findings in January, we acknowledge the limitations that we were not a gender project and that we didn't have a lot of experience of gender intervention. So they immediately linked us to a GBV project that conducted a training in our annual meeting to all the staff on Afaka. We are about 72 people working in the project. So we were trained on what is GBV, what are the causes, the consequences, and more importantly, how to address it at the village level when we conduct our different activities. They've been also very supportive on continuing with the work to understand the impacts of what we can do better, but they're also interested in to see the results since they will use them to further inform other program interventions that use similar activities to the ones we do. So as you can see, we have used quite a holistic approach, and I believe that the interaction with other stakeholders, coupled with the project's actions, are putting us a step closer to change this cultural perceptions, and in doing so, we have started tackling GBV. And just to wrap up, I want to leave you with a couple of reflections. I think this research did not start out looking for gender-based violence, but in the process of measuring the effect of an agricultural intervention, we discovered a hidden problem, one that was harming women and that the project was unaware of. Addressing this was for us not only a matter of doing the right thing, but ensuring that as an inclusive market system project, we were not leaving anyone behind. Krista mentioned at the beginning of her presentation that the cost of GBV, and indirectly we could have been exacerbating this difference and leaving the community worse off. So here's what I want to highlight, the power of evidence. Nafaka embraced a research approach, and we have started to take evidence-based actions that will yield sustainable impact on the community. And in the meantime, the time diaries had an unintended consequence, leading the way to a paradigm shift. Farmers are now aware of how they use their time, and this in itself has empowered them. Knowing how they use their time is the first step to making changes on that time distribution. So in working with farmers, we realized that male household heads are recognizing the amount of activity women do, and they have begun to assist in sharing responsibilities. Couples are also discussing about time management, and that has brought families closer, increased joint making decision, and there's also a higher collaboration at the household level. So NAFACA turned a resource limitation into an opportunity to expose a reality that even though existed, it was somehow invisible because of the lack of data. And we have started to address the roots of a problem that marginalizes women in rural areas. We are confident that the work that we're doing is going to change the lives of women, of the women and men that we work with. And we believe that this could have a ripple effect in their communities. Thanks, and I'll be glad to answer any questions during the Q&A time.
Thank you, Rodrigo. And with that, we will be moving over to our presenters from Unilever.
Hi, everybody. It's Deline here, and I'm with Winfrieda. So we're together in the same room, so we'll be jointly presenting and sharing. And just to give some context, I guess, we were asked if we could share some of our learnings and also programs with yourself, and also a little bit of why Unilever is actually putting in an extensive effort to focus on various things, but GBV is one of the areas of a very important focus for Unilever. So to give a little bit of context, I thought I'd start off with Unilever's vision, and that is to make sustainable living commonplace. And Unilever believes that it's the best way to ensure long-term business growth, and that basically led to a big sustainability program that they've launched. And the clear vision of this program is to find a new way of working as an FMCG, one that delivers growth by serving society and the planet. And so the concerted effort started from there. So the aim is to decouple growth as an FMCG from the environmental footprint, while also at the same time increasing positive social impact. So to do this, Unilever has three very big goals that they want to achieve. And the first one is to improve the health and well-being for more than 1 billion people. The second one is to reduce the environmental impact by half, and I think it's a greater a target by now, looking at the plastic agenda. And then also the third one is to enhance the livelihoods of millions of people. So around that third objective or goal, it is where they've got one of the sub-objectives is to develop opportunities for women and as an area of focus. And to focus on opportunities for women, there's four key areas. The one is to build a gender-balanced organization with focus on management. So we all have targets, and it's a global agenda to ensure that our management on all levels are balanced from a gender perspective. Yeah. They also promote safety for women in communities we operate in. So a lot of our discussion today is really on that part of the Unilever program. Enhancing, of course, access to training and skills, which we also do in our plantations, which is mostly we will touch on today, and then expand opportunities in our value chain. So really it's focused on safety for women in communities, enhancing access to training, development, and supporting gender equality. So a little bit to give context on GB and Unilever. Unilever has a very strong core value system which is focused on purpose, because we believe as Unilever, a company with purpose will thrive and people with purpose will grow and thrive as well. And really with regards to the agenda for gender-based violence, in terms of a company, applying resources and focus on it, it's just the right thing to do. We operate in the plantations. Part of why I'm here is I head up the plantations in East Africa, where we have up to 15,000 people who work for us. But if you add their families, their children, because they live on our plantations, it can be up to 50,000 people we actually have on our plantation. So it is the right thing to do. It's aligned with the company's purpose to focus on the health and well-being of everybody, and in this case, specifically relating to women in agriculture. as Rodrigo also mentioned earlier, and Krista, that a lot of the of our workers in agriculture, a big part of them are women, and hence the focus. And the benefits, there's no real financial, we didn't calculate a financial benefit. That is why it's more aligned with the company's purpose. It's the right thing to do, but of course we want our women to thrive. It does help to improve productivity and in essence, indirectly also business growth, but it's not the primary reason why Unilever has started off many programs, which Winfrieda will share with you. It's really aligned with if we're going to operate where we have large communities and in agriculture, for example, in East Africa, where we're responsible for 15,000 directly and indirectly up to 50,000 people, is make sure that we do the right thing with the community, with our employees. So I'll hand over to Winfrieda that will share a bit more because she drives our program directly and responsible for developing it.
Hi everyone, Winfrieda here from Unilever. Just a bit of context setting. Deline has just given us a brief in terms of this being the right thing to do. For us as Unilever, I think what we are saying is GBV is an endemic issue. It's not only just an agriculture issue. It's beyond agriculture. It's beyond Unilever. So essentially what we are saying is it cuts across different levels of relationship, community, individual. And I think what's important for us as a business is to really look at how this impacts us as a business, how that impacts our people. And as we have, as our purpose really affirms, is that people with purpose thrive. And we want people to thrive. And we want the company also to thrive. So essentially for us, that is one of the main reasons why we really look to address this. And our commitment is actually working closely with different partners to address this issue. If you look at the different countries we're in, we're also very keen to understand what are the prevalence levels, why, what can we do about it, who can we partner with, and I'll be speaking to that in the next as we move on. So I just want to speak into what we believe are the seven practical steps to address GBV. And for us, this is actually from our own experience as Unilever and how we have gone about addressing GBV within our own business, particularly our plantations in the tea sector. One and very core is actually leadership commitment. And without leadership commitment, and first, leadership recognition of the issue, yeah, understanding the issue, understanding what impact it has on the community, what impact it has on the business and your people, and committing to make a difference. And this, of course, will translate into policies, will translate into your goodwill, your engagement, and what you're doing as a leader to make a difference. Your strategy, is it part of your strategy? Is it core? Is it important? Is that the message that you are sending down? So for us, leadership commitment comes out very strongly. And definitely having an unbiased view of the situation is also important to understand what baseline are you having, what is really the issue on the ground, and what will you be addressing? So having that informed view of the situation and having it unbiased and being very clear on what that will help you to determine your interventions, your programs, and how to move forward, even in terms of who do you need in terms of resourcing. And from there, we move to resourcing, building expertise, and having that management buy-in. Remember, this is not a very traditional area for most of our management, because if you look at most businesses, there's that view that profit is actually what drives the business. But slowly there's that change and businesses are starting to recognize that people and profit are pretty much very important and there's really no hierarchy in that regard. So resourcing for Unilever, for us, it's about bringing in the right people. And to be honest, that's how I joined Unilever 6 years ago. So it's bringing the right people with the right knowledge, the right expertise, and even the commitment to make a difference. And the discussion around gender balanced organization is also to just make sure that we have women who also are leaders and can also be able to support other leaders. So women leadership and empowerment programs to help women also grow and women also access the different opportunities and have the right skills and the right leadership skills to do that. And maybe Dileen can speak on the management buying.
Yeah, so I think what's important to note from a, this is more from an obviously an organizational perspective, is we started this program, and people like Winnie has been really great in helping us develop a framework in terms of from to start to work with gender-based violence and these kind of issues. I think the leadership commitment is key. It's important that it's not seen as, so we have a lot of people in from social welfare working on it, working for Unilever, working on this issue, and especially with me here in East Africa. But it's not, it should not be seen as a social welfare issue. It's from top down, a leadership recognition, admitting there's an issue, and then working with HR, even security and welfare, and then make it a cross-functional drive supported by the business. Even our managers who manage their parts of their plantations need to own that this is an important agenda and support our welfare, HR, and security teams that are working on the safety and the health and security of people. So it's really pretty much the message that it's a joint effort, and it's supported across. So even the commitment that we can't just talk the talk in saying that we recognize the issue, it's actually funding it, the programs, actually putting money behind it. So Unilever does put a lot of money behind this issue, for example. We do a lot of work with the UN Women, as an example, and but also resources, headcount, actually, hence, you know, recognizing that part of doing business, you need that as part of your investment.
Investing in people.
Investing in people, in the communities, and for the health and well-being of those communities.
Yeah. Okay. So I think I've spoken briefly in terms of integration, and by integration I mean this addressing GBV, whether it's sexual harassment in the workplace, whether it's intimate partner violence, any form of GBV is actually not a by the way. It's actually supposed to be our core responsibility. So people are our core responsibility, and that's why every manager, every leader is actually involved and responsible for the well-being of their people, the health and well-being of their people. And maybe just to speak briefly on one of the things that we did when we started, is we actually had to revamp our own strategy, our own strategy, and ensure that we had what we call social good as one of the pillars of ensuring that that our business thrives. So just making sure that there's that call out on this is important, and this is part of our DNA as a business. The other thing which is important and also really helps close that loop in terms of addressing these issues is having an effective grievance mechanism. A lot has been spoken about effective grievance mechanism and what makes it effective, but I would speak to it has to be trusted. You have to trust the grievance mechanism. People have to know that you're not only accessible, but that you will do something about the reports that they give you, and that they can always get remedy, or they can always get feedback, and they can always be satisfied with the remedy that they get. And ensuring that you get learnings from those grievance mechanisms. One of the things that we actually did was to have a toll-free hotline to just make sure that people are able to report without the barriers of finances or, you know, cost. And also make sure that the confidentiality is also very key for us here. So grievance mechanisms comes in for us very important. But like I said, we are more proactive in terms of focusing on prevention and ensuring that response is actually a small bit of what we do. Then recognizing that as a business, this might not be our core expertise. So we also bring in other actors. The nonprofit, other organizations. We've worked with quite a number of organizations, both locally and globally, to deliver our agenda of zero GBV or reducing GBV within our business, and collaborating with UN Women. And I'll be speaking to the work we've done with UN Women briefly as we move on. And that for us presents really, it helps us to strengthen the model that we have currently, and continuing to improve and address our issues both within our plantation but also without, looking at the communities that we work with, the smallholder farmers, and supporting the community as a whole. Then finally in this process, and just wrap it up in terms of the steps, is monitoring progress and reporting, and always looking to learn and continuously improve our model in this space. So maybe just to speak on the UN Women Program, we initiated a partnership in 2016 with UN Women. And this partnership was predominantly to strengthen, at that time we had a safety for women, girls and boys model in Kericho. And so the partnership was initially to strengthen this model and help us develop an evidence-based approach or model that would work for us and something that we can replicate beyond Kericho, beyond the tea sector, and develop a framework, and that's what we have on your right-hand side, the Global Women's Safety Framework that can be used with our suppliers, can be used in the agricultural sector to be able to help them to implement, to promote safety within their workspaces. So this has been a journey, and just to briefly speak on how that looks like, I was speaking to prevention as the one of the strongest pillars that really takes predominantly like 80% of our time. We focus mostly on prevention and ensuring that we are very, we're proactive in terms of how we protect our people and our detection mechanism, working with our security team, both internally and externally, to make sure that we are very clear, that we understand the signs and we have the early warning signs of what could be what wrong, and mapping different hotspots, understanding the trends. For example, when you have bonuses being paid out, what are the risks, what could be the issues that could emerge from there, and being proactive about it, by having the detection mechanisms in place. I've spoken to response, which for us, one of the things that I'd like to really emphasize here is one of the things, psychosocial support really plays a very big role when it comes to response, and that is the area where most of us normally miss it. We don't really look to address the trauma that our survivors and their families face, and for us this is a very big part of our response, in addition to ensuring that the cases have been reported both internally and externally, and the redress mechanisms, the remedies have been issued, but also to ensure that the trauma is also, our survivors and their families are also are counseled and supported beyond the issues that they're facing. Then I've spoken to external engagement. This really is part of our strengthening our programs and ensuring that we have a holistic intervention. So just to wrap it up, maybe just to speak to the Global Women's Safety Framework. This is a framework that is available to all of us, and it's available beyond any sector in agriculture could use this framework, and we are also very open to share any learning on this framework and to also share it across if that would be of interest. Thank you.
Great. Thank you so much, Delene and Winfrieda. We will open up to Q&A in a few minutes. But I first want to thank you for your presentations, all three of you, and also note your point that you made with Rina and Delene about being proactive, about watching and being aware, having those processes, whether they be grievance mechanisms or others in place, but also your point about kind of what can we do more to really acknowledge and help people work through the trauma, and is that our role, I think is an open question as agricultural programs. But I appreciate that both of our examples, you know, really did reach out to others in their area with expertise. So before we go into the Q&A, I wanted to highlight three selected tools for preventing and responding to gender-based violence in the agriculture sector. These are not all of the tools, and hopefully soon there will be more. The first is USAID's toolkit for integrating GBV prevention and response into economic growth projects. It has sections specifically for agriculture and food security, as well as value chain development, enterprise development, access to finance, trade policy, and cross-border trade, all of which are relevant to agriculture. And it has steps for activity design and implementation, as well as illustrative indicators. It has several kind of guides and recommendations. I won't go through all of them, but some of them do speak to mapping stakeholders and institutions around your project that can help with gender-based violence and have those expertise. Working with women leaders and building women's leadership, especially in producer organizations, but also building women farmers' capacity for bargaining and negotiation, as well as identifying coping strategies for lean seasons, which can be a time of increased gender-based violence. The second tool is from the Food and Agriculture Organization. How can we protect men, women, and children from gender-based violence? Addressing GBV in the food security and ag sector. This uses the perspective of FAO's program cycle and is more specific to their work, but it does speak to cash and voucher programs, which I know is of interest for a lot of us. It has several case studies and some guidance on how to do needs assessment, referral procedures, setting up feedback mechanisms with your communities, and monitoring, evaluation, and learning. And I've also provided the link to the tool that Unilever and UN Women worked on, so I won't go any further into that. But now I'd like to hand it over to Jen Williamson from ACDI Boca to talk about some upcoming work we're doing.
Hi, this is Jen Williamson. I am not only the senior gender advisor for the Senior Advisor for Gender and Social Inclusion at ACDI Boca, but I'm also the Gender and Agriculture Systems Advisor for the Advancing Women's Empowerment Project, funded by Feed the Future's Bureau for Food Security. As you know, the gender-based violence in agriculture theme is a partnership between the Advancing Women's Empowerment Project and AgriLinks. And our project, Advancing Women's Empowerment, is very much focused on learning around how we can promote women's empowerment in the agriculture sector. So we also provide a lot of opportunities for capacity building and learning how we can do our jobs better and this work better in this sector. So we have received support to do learning as a learning agenda under this project, and we are going to be working on this learning agenda for the next few years. It has three learning streams, which we're launching right now. We're very excited about them. The first learning stream, you will not be surprised to hear, is focused on gender-based violence in agriculture. So we're very excited to kick this off. And the first activities we'll actually be doing will be focused on identifying tools and resources to better support this work. We are aware, after doing an evidence scan and a consultation process that involved speaking to stakeholders and experts in both the USAID sector, implementers, a variety of people, that there is a lack of resources specifically targeting agriculture and how to address gender-based violence. So we want to help that situation and learn how we can do this better. We know that there are more resources in other sectors. So we're starting off by collecting and learning about those resources, finding out what's out there, what's working, and how we can bring some resources from the existing knowledge into agriculture. So that's our first step in the gender-based violence learning agenda, and we'll be sharing more about that as we go through that process. There will be more activities after that, but we'll be sharing that as we go forward. We have two other learning streams. The first one we're embarking on as well, simultaneously with gender-based violence, is about promoting women's empowerment in beyond production. As you know, a lot of the work we do in agriculture is targeted at the production level, but a lot of really important work happens outside of production as we're working in value chains and market systems. So we're also looking to capture learning and best practices and how to promote women's empowerment in these really important areas. So that's also embarking with looking at what's happening, what are best practices, how are we measuring it, how are we promoting it, and we're also going to be doing some impact assessments as part of that. So that is also coming. We're hoping to add a third learning stream after that around decision making. I've already seen some questions about this, and as you know, decision-making is obviously a very important element. We've already been looking at decision-making in production through the Women's Empowerment in Agriculture Index and coming through the PROWEA in a number of important ways. But we know that decision-making is a very complex process and connects to many important things like decision-making over production, but also income. So this is a learning stream that's in development, and we're hoping to come to you sooner rather than later with more information about that. But we're not learning for learning's sake. We're learning for application, so we will be coming to you with more information on that.
Great. Thank you, Jen, for summarizing that so well on the fly. I'm sorry we didn't have a slide for you.